stuff that really is very disruptive to the lives of homeless people and poor people, but it's so petty for them to do. You know, it's really bad karma for their souls. You know, let us bow our heads for a second and pray for police officers. But still, yeah, you really are upset. I know you have to do that street interviewing stuff, and you know how upset I got when I heard about what they were doing with, you know, that one. I don't want to mention anybody's name, but using someone's paranoia to as a reason to ticket somebody else.
You're talking about the Brazda case, and we're about to actually refer to that in greater detail. Yeah.
It really pissed me off to watch that go down. You know, what petty police officers. You know, they've become
that
way.
The audience should know that you're like referring to a case of a man who was sort of angrily hurling taunts. And, why don't you tell us what happened again, David?
Well, I was there, you know, as the incident was over, so I was hearing reports pretty much.
So you didn't actually see the incident?
I didn't see the incident.
We actually got a report from Chris Brozda in jail. We're going to talk about that later.
I heard the host, however, being interviewed by the police officer that gave the ticket. Mm-hmm. And the host was saying, nothing happened. Brozda didn't do anything. The other guy didn't do anything. You know, there was just a claim made.
You're talking, of course, about an incident that where Brozda and I guess Bruce the Stick Man, we've had both these people on the air, got into a dispute, and they were angry with each other. They both felt that
I don't think that, you know, according to what the host was saying, they really weren't that angry. It wasn't that big of a dispute.
But didn't Brozda call the police?
That's the problem, yeah. But
yeah, I think he was trying to file a complaint. In any case, I don't wish to bemuse our audience with sort of these arcane incidents, but you're talking about a big community affair tomorrow night at the Committee to Repeal the Sleeping Bans, Hung Dong Bong Bong, Down and Dirty Dance.
As you know, we've been very successful in having many, many different kinds of organizations endorse this, and we're hoping that all their memberships will be coming. You know, we've got some phone alerts. Some of them are doing telephone trees on their organizations. We did a couple of targeted mailings, but we've also got signs up, and it just represents a nice, progressive common ground, which is a new progressive common ground, because the word progressive has like been really twisted and distorted in this town for so long.
Now, so you're telling me that bands like Slow Gherkin are going to go play at this affair?
With Wellspring, leading opening for them. You know,
tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Veterans Hall.
7 o'clock. You can hear Slow Gherkin at starting at 10. We'll have Wellspring starting about 7:30. Have Mark Levy after that.
What about my three-hour speech? When do I get to make that?
Your three-hour speech is going to be recorded, and it's going to be cut into the long edited director's cut version.
Okay, so that will be probably between 2 in the morning and 5?
Yeah, and you'll be able to buy that at Blockbuster Video.
Oh, great.
This is a big production. This really is a pretty nice show. People really will get them. For $7, you're getting a, $50-$60 show.
Wow. You know. But what about refreshments? Do people have to bring their own booze or what?
We will have security. We will be checking people. We really would like people to behave as much as possible and still enjoy themselves as much as possible. We will have refreshments inside.
What about, this is going to be a marijuana-free event, or?
We will have Theodore Carey speaking, giving a statement from Dennis Perone, who is under siege in San Francisco now as we speak.
Theodore Carey, of course, is one of our local Holy Amp sisters, and Dennis Perone is the Republican gubernatorial candidate who has recently retired as the head of the San Francisco Cannabis Club in order to solve some of that club's legal problems, but is continuing to fight for the right to use medical marijuana.
So he's under siege there. Mm-hmm. We have another message from the Green Party gubernatorial candidate who's under siege at Ward Valley, where they're trying to dump middle-grade nuclear waste, if you could imagine such a concept. Mm. And so he's sending a statement, too. And we have, we have a message from Bill Mann. There'll be some people from around sending us statements of good luck and so forth. So, but mostly it won't be speeches. Mostly it will be music. Some of the music's going to be political. A little bit of it's going to be kind of hard-hitting political. But it's also going to be a kind of a love fest with Wellspring. I think Wellspring's going to set a nice tone where we'll all see that we need to like work in unity. There's going to be tables from different, the No One 226 people will be there, so labor will be represented. The anti-fluoridation people will be there with the table.
What about Cynthia Matthews and the pro-fluoridation people?
Cynthia Matthews and the pro-fluoridation people don't need a table. They need to look at the water table.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, what about toothpaste? Are we going to get a special special free tube of Crest as we
this
come in?
This is the thing about the great American capitalist system. It's the free enterprise, you have free choice. You don't have much choice when it comes to candidates, but when it comes to toothpaste, you have lots of choice.
Excellent, but don't all those have
I use eggshells myself for toothpaste.
I see. That's rather interesting.
Well, that's the Shaklee product.
Well, let me. So we've got this big concert happening. Do you need? Have you resolved all your financial and security problems? Are you still inviting people to come as security?
Well, we are right at the right number for our. We had to have an extra security in order to, not lose our security deposit and not limit the number of people to be in there. We wouldn't have the place filled. Because with every security guard that we don't have that's willing to commit from 6:45 to 12:15, we lose the capacity of 30 more people. So we have to really have 13 committed people. We've got 13 people now to do security, but if some more people want to come and show up at 6:45 to be security and do security for us, that's great. We have a couple of muscle men to do with the unloading of the trucks at 3:30, and we have a couple of technicians to assist with our professional sound man. Even that sound equipment needs a little bit of special security. People, if somebody's willing to sit in the balcony and watch the show so that the sound stuff up there can be more secure. And we don't want people, coming in the side doors and the exits and so forth. We really would like to get at least a few bucks from everybody in order to be able to pay the homeless people that are, gathering signatures. That's what this is for.
Mm-hmm. For the initiative to repeal the sleeping ban.
Yeah, for the initiative to repeal the sleeping ban. Let's take the thorn out of the heart of Santa Cruz.
Wow. Well, that's an interesting unpaid commercial announcement you got there, David Solak. What? Any other reports on have you gotten the update on what happened this afternoon at the? I guess it was the Beach Flats Third Street Realignment.
No, I haven't heard anything, but I did get a call from. I won't mention his name since it's a legal case, and I haven't got the permission to. But I did get a call from a resident of Beach Flats who, his door was kicked in by the Seaside security officers. When they had heard a rumor that somebody had kicked the door of Surf Bowl, They decided to come across the parking lot and actually go onto a home in Second Avenue there, where that part of the homes they're going to demolish. And so the lawyer was interested in how many other homes the Seaside Security Company have kicked the doors down in. If there's any people out there that live in Beach Flats that have had that experience, they can get in touch with you through me. Or me through you.
Sure, give a call to 423-HUFF, H-U-F-F. If your door has been kicked in by either a Santa Cruz police officer or a Seaside security guard person.
In the area where specifically in the area where they're going to be tearing down houses for this development.
And we're talking about down near the boardwalk.
Yeah. So while I didn't hear anything from the report, there's, activity that's going to be...
And the number to call again is 423-HUFF, 423-HUFF.
Just call that number if you have any information at all. This person's got a real, real strong case, and it will tie
it sounds like Seaside Security is really kind of kicking down doors and acting in a rather inappropriate manner. We heard on the air a couple months ago, Shaz, the fidget man himself, was... dragged across the ground and thrown into handcuffed and sent to jail for simply asking about the Seaside Company's regulation, a very bizarre regulation that they apparently still have posted, which says that if you come onto Seaside property, then you must surrender your skateboard and or bicycle, and if they tell you to leave, they can also confiscate your bicycle and or skateboard for, 24 hours,
something like that. Yeah.
And if you don't agree to that, they can give you a trespass citation for a year, a stay-away order for a year. I mean, it just sounded really weird and really kind of repressive. And when Shaz just asked about that, the Seaside guards ended up dragging him off to jail. It was quite something.
The Seaside Company is trying to charm this town into allowing them to expand. They certainly are going about it the wrong way. There's a lot of difference between Rio de Janeiro, Miami Vice development, and Mussolini kind of tactics.
They're trying to bridge the gap.
I don't know what they're doing, but they're doing it all wrong, and they're gonna lose this fight because of just having their head in the air and the arrogance of this power that they've had for so long.
Well, I don't know.
Could be a functional part of this community.
It seems to me the arrogance of the Seaside Company is certainly matched and trumped by the arrogance of the city council that they're appealing to, at least the majority on that city council. In fact, I'm about to play the second part of a conversation I had this morning with Phil Baer, kind of an update.
Because I really don't know what happened at that meeting.
Well, I'm going to give that
update. I was running around.
This is not an update on that meeting, but this sort of is this is an update on what has happened before the meeting around the Beach Flats redevelopment. So if there isn't any more you've got to say, David, I'm going to move right into
there is going to be a fundraiser for the Beach Flats One woman is organizing it. It looks like it's going to be at Palookaville, something like the 23rd or something like that. So keep your ears open, folks, if you want to help these people save their homes.
Okay, we'll be announcing more about that on Free Radio Santa Cruz as the event comes closer. And
certainly, Friday is coming real close, so everybody show up tomorrow night and fork over a few bucks so we can make this thing happen.
Definitely.
Okie doke.
Thanks, David.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, that was Community Repeal, the Sleeping Ban activist, Green Party god, and ongoing former city council candidate, David Silva. Also, apparently, the one of the litigants in a lawsuit suing the city, the police department, Mayor Mike Rodkin, and Andy Crane for police abuse in 1996. As I promised, we're going to pick up on the Phil Bear tape. Phil is a local activist who lives in the Beach Flats. He's also a landlord there. And we had him talking about this issue earlier today because there was a meeting at 3 o'clock concerning the plan by the Seaside Company to expand into the Beach Flats, demolish housing there, set up a hotel complex, widen the streets, a whole series of events that would essentially redevelop that area without providing, as far as I'm, it's not clear to me that there's any guarantees of housing for the people being displaced. As well as any real political process that takes into account what most people are saying about the project, which is don't do it. That's familiar to those of you who followed the Pelton Street property situation, where Scott Kennedy, Mike Rotkin, Cynthia Matthews, Michael Hernandez, and Mary Beth Campbell, the city council, fearful five, or fearsome five, unless that's what you want to call them, frightful five, they rammed through their sell the Pelton Street property in spite of the thousands of Santa Cruz registered city voters who said, no, no, wait, we don't need to do that. We don't need to disperse the homeless garden project, to disrupt the community gardens, and to put up $700,000 homes at this time. But Rotkin turned a deaf ear, as did his colleagues on the council. So that's something they do. Let's continue listening to what we played earlier, not on this show, but earlier in the day, a report from Phil Bear about what's been happening around the issue of the Beach Flats. He's talked about a number of issues immediately prior to what we're going to tune in on this tape. He's talked about housing problems. He's talked about tidelands problems, I believe. He's talked about how the public process is being ignored. And we're going to kind of join the tape at this point, and then we're going to try to reach Phil live on the air to get the update on what actually happened this afternoon.
Now, some concerns have been raised in the recent past have been the water supply, the inability of the city to have enough water for this expanded development. I should say the inadequate supply is even now.
Yes.
And also concerns that the property that is being eminently domained or whatever contains protected marshlands. I'm not quite sure about that.
There's a big issue of tideland pertaining to practically the entirety of the so-called Third Street parking lot along the lower estuary in the main beach, that is to say the west side of the river, mm-hmm. At the estuary, including the land on which the amusement park expansion is proposed. The point being that Article 10, Section 3 of the California State Constitution grants all tidelands within 2 miles of any municipality into the public. It's supposed to remain in public title and used for public purposes. Tidelands being all the land that was below the mean high tide line as the land existed in its natural state, regardless, in other words, of subsequent fill, or in this case, the building of a levee that strangled the estuary over against the eastern bank, and then a bunch of fill on top of what formerly was the estuary. Regardless of that kind of artificial accretion, as it's called, if it was below the mean high tide line as the land existed in its natural state, it is supposed to remain forever in public ownership and publicly accessible. That that's an issue that is now being examined by the California State Lands Commission, also being grossly mishandled by the city in terms of the city's failure to pursue the public's interest, and handled in closed session so that the public doesn't even know what's being going on under the rationale that there is pending litigation. I don't even know what they're talking about in terms of pending litigation, but supposedly because there is pending litigation, they are justified in violating the Brown Act and doing the entire negotiation in closed session so that we don't even know what deal they're cooking up. But that's all going concurrently with this BSAW plan, and is being handled at breakneck speed and in the most quiet manner they could possibly evolve, in the manner most clearly designed to lock out public input and prevent public awareness of what they're doing. It's just so anti-democratic.
Now, Councilmember Michael Hernandez, who frequently rises to defend the rights of minorities, specifically the Hispanic minority, as he should, has apparently been quoted as saying that he feels two council members, Byers and Scott, are in essence drawing the color line, in essence being racist, and trying to block this Beach Flats plan, which will benefit the Hispanic population there, and also specifically those Hispanic folks who want jobs involved in this project, which I assume will be numerous. What's your sense about that?
I couldn't agree with Mr. Hernandez's assessment there. As I examine the relocation law that pertains to this situation and the city policies that have been adopted, it looks to me like they're going to replace the housing that will be lost with an equal or greater number of supposedly superior housing, though that all depends on your sense of what good housing is and the degree to which you want to live in a project. But the point there is that they replacing the housing that is lost in no way addresses the housing needs of the specific individuals and families whose houses will be destroyed in order to clear the site for this housing project. My understanding of these particular people and their circumstances is that they will not qualify for the replacement housing for various reasons, because the best promise that has been made, and it only a promise, I don't think many people really believe, is that the housing that will be built will be made available to anybody above the 20th percentile within the city in terms of income. In other words, the poorest 20% would not qualify because they don't earn enough. And this is a low-income neighborhood. These people, by and large, almost entirely will be in the lower 20%, so they won't qualify for the housing. So what will they get? They'll get a subsidy on the rent that they are now paying. The difference between the rent they are now paying, which is really quite reasonable by Santa Cruz standards, and the rent that they will have to pay on a relocation rental that they probably will have to find, and that'll probably amount to a significant difference in that subsidy, except it's a temporary subsidy, so that after the subsidy ceases, these people will be facing a much higher rent that they will not be able to afford without the subsidy.
How many people
shortly thereafter will be out on their butts?
How many people are we talking about, Phil?
That is not a fixed number. My sense of it, assuming they do the minimum number that they're talking about doing, something like 18 to 23 units, and if I understand exactly which 18 to 23 units they're talking about, I would say that 150 permanent residents might be a pretty
Mm-hmm.
And that's just, of course, first phase. The plan calls for the removal of 78 units of housing in the beach flats and 162 units of housing in the entire project area. So when you're getting into those numbers, you're talking about, 400 to 500 people, at least.
Now, Councilmember Kennedy has said that you yourself are a landlord in the beach flats.
Yes, I saw him yesterday attending some meeting down here. It was kind of ironic. He was pulling away in this brand-new spiffy station wagon vehicle as I climb into my 78 Toyota Celica, and I'm thinking, let's see, I'm the rich slumlord, and he's the self-sacrificing public servant.
Mm-hmm.
The disparity struck me as sort of humorous.
He has said that you are renting, I don't know, how big of a landlord are you in the beach flats? How many people do you rent to? What is your average rent?
Oh, yeah, well, a fraction, all those figures. We have 6 rental units that are affordable by Santa Cruz standards. Well, we have a studio that we rent for $300 a month, and the most we get is $700, and it includes the utilities. That's a 3-bedroom for $700. You know, it's quite cheap by Santa Cruz standards. We pay utilities, and we even pay for the parking permit fee that the city just managed to jack up this year in spite of the profitability of that program, and we pay for the kid. You know, our income is exceedingly modest, as anybody who knows us can quickly.
How long have you lived in the area, Phil?
About 20 years now.
And we're talking about how many units that you are a landlord over?
6.
So you're not really a major landlord.
No, I don't fit the absentee rich slumlord. Twirling my mustache and laughing maniacally about the suffering I'm inflicting upon the poor people image that that Kennedy and his ilk love to just throw around. It's almost like a form of a racial epithet or something. Landlord, it's like it's illegal and immoral and vile and disgusting. The mere mention of the word landlord is like all he has to do to totally discredit anything we say.
Now, is Kennedy has also claimed, and he will, of course, be appearing on this show on May 17th in order to probably discuss this, debate this issue further with critics, that you are renting out to upper middle class students, getting lots of money for it, and yet claiming to represent the interests of lower-income Hispanic people. What do you say to that?
Let's see. We don't have any students at all right now. We have in the past. I don't know about their family background, but other than our own children who are college students, we don't have at the present time any students at all, and absolutely nobody who I would describe as upper middle class. I don't know that they would be categorized as even solid middle class.
Mm-hmm.
Our people are lower middle class to lower, you know, just hanging on by their bootstraps. If they didn't have our rentals, they'd probably be out of the city, actually.
Mm-hmm. What percentage of these, forgive me for asking, are Hispanic?
At the present time, let's see.
Or Latino?
Two. What percentage that would translate to would be something like, 10%, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
We have had more Latinos in the past and have no problem right, my wife is reminding me, out of 6 houses, one household is Latino, one household, yes, Mexican specifically, one household is Polynesian, actually, and one household is Afro-American.
to switch very briefly to another subject, though, again, I think I encourage people to come to the 3 o'clock City Council session at 809 Center Street in downtown Santa Cruz, right across from the main library.
Right.
And from the Civic Auditorium.
Other place.
You've heard some no doubt about the Resource Center for Nonviolence plan to accept money for the cops,
right,
from the Department of Justice. What's the significance of this, and what's your feeling about it?
Well, I don't care for it, you know. I always thought that the Resource Center for Nonviolence stood as some sort of alternative to a police sort of approach to social problems, which is not to invalidate the police approach, but having both approaches clearly represented and separated, that is to say, at least one organization in the city that was openly anti-military, anti-violence, anti-domestic violence, anti-boxing at the Civic, anti-realistic toy guns sold to children. You know, that range, that perspective and that range of concerns deserves its own organization. And to see that muddied through some sort of close tie-in with the police. I mean, there's a trillion other organizations in town that are closely affiliated with the police. I don't see why one little peacenik organization has to go that way, too. It sort of defeats its purpose, to my way of thinking.
Some of us are wondering why the police came to the Resource Center for Nonviolence to ask them to be the conduit for this money, which essentially funds a position of an individual who works with the police in dealing with crime in, I guess it's the Lower Ocean Beach Flats area, or south of Laurel, I'm not sure how it's put right there, that general area. And they said that the funding was initially intended to go to this other organization run by Eric Larson. What was it called? The
Neighbors of Lower Ocean Street, I believe.
Right, and that apparently that organization had dissolved or...
Something like that. I think it dissolved over exactly that issue. Most of those people did not care for the idea of linking up as a neighborhood organization tightly identifying with the police quite so much. And that's what happened to that. The lower Ocean Street neighborhood still exists, but it is no longer supportive of Eric Larson and this police grant.
There was some discussion about this in a forum at the Resource Center a week ago.
I missed it.
Yeah, Kennedy. Well, I think there was something else going on the same evening. Kennedy and Larson were talking at length about the history of the controversy in the Resource Center for Nonviolence. They mentioned briefly the impact of the Resource Center's program of going after slumlords. Apparently, I don't know if they went after you or not, or they considered you a slumlord.
Oh, they consider me a slumlord. They haven't gone after me.
Let me ask you, the program of suing slumlords and getting money
right.
For that, what's your feeling about, has that been a good program, a bad program? What want to describe briefly what it's involved? That Eric Larson, I guess, is one of the folks influential in that, and the Resource Center as well.
Right. Well, as I understand, what they attempted to do there, they actually lost on the action against the Goodens. It was in the 300 block of Lower Ocean. This is just my understanding. I'm not really on top of this one, but they took the Goodens to court on the basis of something like maintaining a public nuisance, and it was tossed out entirely. So I don't know that was really a terribly effective thing, though he certainly got a lot of media play out of it. The Sentinel seemed to love it, but it did not withstand a court challenge.
Has the work of Larson's organization had much impact either positive or negative, independent of this proposed, this actually has it's a fait accompli, this COPS grant. That's what they call it, a COPS grant. It's not just in my slang.
Yes. Well, yeah, that's good.
Has anything happened during the last 3 years with this organization that...
Well, no. There has been a significant improvement in both Lower Ocean Street and in the beach flats, for which these organizations are, of course, taking credit. I don't believe that. I believe that the change occurred simply because Police Chief Belcher, for whatever reasons, came in and did a much better job than had his predecessor, and sent a couple of cops who I thought were very good cops, or at least I never saw them do anything that I thought was objectionable, down. And in rather short order, with rather few busts, they were able to get rid of a scene which had been plaguing both neighborhoods for years. And what it suggested to me is that that this scene was always far more solvable than it was presented as being.
Are you talking about drug sales and prostitution?
Essentially. Prostitution was more in the Lower Ocean Street area, though not much of that, really. That was sort of overblown. All of this was terribly overblown. At the same time, it was under-addressed. But the Lower Ocean had some streetwalkers, and the flats had some on-street gang heroin selling going on public streets and public sidewalks. I hasten to add, it was not primarily done out of private residents. It was not done by local residents. It was done by the neighborhood sellers and sold to out-of-neighborhood buyers on public, non-private streets, just by way of indicating why the residents and the property owners weren't more able to directly address the situation. It was inherently a police matter, and the police were very negligent about it for 15 years, during which both neighborhoods, particularly the flats, were plagued by the problem. So then they send a couple of policemen down here who can just sort of fairly politely discourage it, and it disappears. It all suggests to me a problem that was tolerated for some reason, but which should have and could have been taken out of here 15 years ago, in which case all of this incessant and very tedious bad-mouthing of the beach flats couldn't have occurred.
Now, activist Linda LeMaster.
And you're listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3, and we're in an interview with community activist Phil Baer. We had that interview earlier before a meeting of the City Council on the 3rd Street realignment, a special Thursday afternoon meeting. And Phil went to that meeting, and we've tracked him down to his house again. We're going to get an update from him within seconds, so hold on to your radio knobs.
Hi, Phil. You're on the air with Free Radio Santa Cruz.
All right. And I'm holding on to my radio knob.
Well,
don't tell your audience that.
Well, I won't go into any further discussion
on that.
So you went to this this 3 p.m. City Council meeting, and what happened?
Well, it was the presentation of the plan for the 3rd Street realignment, and a couple of the consultants who this had been handed to, one having to do with the engineering on several different alternative placements for this this 3rd Street realignment, new road that lops off one end of the flats to enable the boardwalk to expand, basically. The engineer, and then also was a fellow there who was going to do a study that analyzed the costs of the project and the benefits both to the Seaside Company and to the city by way of figuring out some sort of formula for assigning the costs, how much these companies should pay, how much...
Do you have any idea or any estimate yourself, just looking in, that as a man who studied this somewhat, how much this is going to cost?
Actually, I was finding myself knowing stuff that many of our fabled council members didn't seem to know. I apparently have studied it more than they.
How much?
I hear certain numbers. We've constantly said that it's crucial information, that it's absolutely impossible to say yes or no to a plan until you've got some kind of idea of who's going to be expected to pay for it and what it might cost. None of that's been forthcoming. I've heard little bits. I heard that the Redevelopment Agency actually commissioned a study in 97 determined that the 3rd Street realignment was going to be worth $2 million a year, I believe, to the Seaside Company, but that figure seemed too high to the Redevelopment Agency for some reason, and they sort of sat on that study, but I have it from a pretty good source that occurred. And then I see an estimate in the EIR, or is it the beach area plan, I don't know which, but one of those documents, saying that the 3rd Street realignment will cost $2.7 to $2.8 million. That presumably, or one would ordinarily expect that to be essentially a public expense, taxpayer-borne expense. And then I finally got a projection out of them for the amount of money that the expansion of the amusement park would be expected to generate directly to the city in terms of increased tax revenues, and that figure, it turns out, is in the range of $88,000 a year, a mere pittance, meaning that it would take like 30 or 40 years.
You got to be patient.
Right, they're in it for the long haul, apparently, for 30 or 40 years just to recover the cost of building the damn street. So on the surface of what I've heard, which is all that anybody seems to know, you know, including the council members who shrug their shoulders and look the other way when I ask this question, so on the basis of the available information, it seems like a very lousy business deal from the city's standpoint.
Was there the meeting very well attended this afternoon?
There was a fairly good crowd for a meeting that nobody even heard about until, I don't know, a couple of days ago at the most, not a regularly scheduled meeting, which would be a Tuesday meeting, totally special, unprecedented. I don't know when they have these meetings like this on something like this.
How many folks showed up?
Let's see. I guess I would call it maybe 40 to 50. I think about 12 people spoke to the plan. I'm trying to think if anybody seemed to like the plan. No, I think out of the 12, everybody spoke basically skeptically, if not overtly in objection to the plan.
Now, were there any votes taken of any significance by the council?
They sent the consultants back to study these several alternatives and to work up some sort of cost and benefits analysis, judging from the factors that they requested be considered in this cost benefits analysis. I don't know that they're really going to begin to touch upon, I think they'll get the benefits, that the CCI company will make sure that they know how much taxes it's going to generate, which as I understand is not a lot, but that benefit will be there, and then all of the assumed benefits about how it will increase tourism and thus up the hotel-motel business, which will translate to increased tourist overnight transient tax, all of which is pretty iffy. What won't be known is the actual cost to the city. They didn't even count into what would be calculated as a cost related to the project, the cost of mitigating the traffic increases caused by the proposed expansion, having to do with improvements to 8 intersections along the Ocean Street corridor, which will be a considerable cost directly necessitated by the increased expansion traffic, and that's not even being counted in as a cost to be borne by the taxpayer.
So in other words, we have the cost regarding the cost-benefit analysis. Right now, it looks like...
You get the benefits, but not the cost.
You get 2.7 million cost, but
right.
$88,000 a year benefit.
That's the essence of what I know, with some considerable direct financial benefit to the Seaside Company when the city gets $88,000 per year from the boardwalk expansion. That's 5% of the increase in the admissions and the parking tax. So if you did 20 times that to account for the other 95%, 20 times $88,000 would be the profit to the boardwalk, and that would be a more substantial number.
Well, perhaps we should all buy stock in the Seaside Company.
It would be a sound investment.
Hmm.
That or nuclear energy is supposed to be coming back.
Ah, well, hey. You know, it's interesting. Some people listening to Bathrop Spears Broadsides, which is what you're tuned to on 96.3 FM,
tell me about it.
Yeah, are wondering why are we talking about this rather intricate redevelopment plan, which doesn't seem to directly impact civil rights for poor people. But in fact, when the city is spending money on something like this, it
Absolutely.
Is not spending money on something else. For example, a low-income campground, for instance, housing, affordable housing, shelter space, retraining its police so they aren't shooting people down, as has happened twice in the last 7 months.
Yep.
We also talked to you earlier today in a section which wasn't played on this particular section of Bathrop Spears Broadsides, and you gave us sort of an analysis of the impact on low-income people of this this beach flats redevelopment. Did you get a sense of any new faces or were any new arguments made by people on the council?
No. I heard one council member, I guess I won't mention names, but at a meeting the other day, assert that their hope was to have an affordable housing project constructed before the people were displaced by the Third Street realignment, so that the people could move straight into it. And I asked if he had, or the city had somehow devised some sort of means of assuring that the particular individuals and families would, in fact, be able to move into this housing, at which time he started talking about their intentions.
Uh-huh. Who is this council member?
Oh, that was Mr. Hernandez.
Michael Hernandez.
You are a rumor monger, aren't you, Robert?
Well, hardly. This is a public hearing. Probably it's all agendized.
I know.
This is Michael Celia Scott and Catherine Byers, our racists, Hernandez.
Yes. Yes, that's him.
Yeah, well, that was his claim. Apparently, according to David Silva, and actually another individual who directly overheard that conversation where Michael Hernandez was talking to two students from Liverpool and denouncing council members as drawing the color line and trying
yes.
to cut
Yes, really difficult to believe, really. That level of vituperativeness is so unseemly, I must say, and not the only example that one could provide. And ironic in the sense that it is, in fact, particularly the Latinos, the low-income Latinos within the project area, who do not meet the minimum income requirements. Which in the very best case scenario would require that they be above the 20th percentile within the city annual income continuum. And these are people that are definitely in that lower 20th percentile and would not get into the housing essentially because they don't earn enough.
Well, I think Hernandez...
So those are the people, you know, the low-income Latinos are exactly the people who will be most severely shafted by this, and that doesn't seem to bother Michael, and he really does not have a plan to save those people.
Well, I guess they're talking about busing or light railing these people in from sort of the Watsonville slum areas to work in the area, do all the dirty work, and then busing them out again. I mean, is that the plan?
Could be. There are a lot of very ingenious little scams by which these people manage to keep their labor costs down by employing a lot of subsidized, federally subsidized housing to make up the difference between the inadequate wages that they pay them and what the housing costs. And then some of them actually provide the housing so that they get this big taxpayer Section 8 kind of benefit that goes directly to them. So the same person who underpays the workers gets a lot of money from the federal government through the Section 8 program to make up the difference in an overpriced rental unit so that they get that money and they get the money they save by not paying their workers working wage. It's pretty Machiavellian, actually.
Getting back to the council meeting, Phil Bear, how did things go? Was most of the meeting public commentary, or was it discussion around, I guess you say it was discussion as to the cost-benefit analysis, and they sent it back to committee? Was that the general?
Yeah, it was, the way they usually handle these things is the consultants or the city staff comes in and spends their magic, and then by the time that's over, the public is either asleep or racing to out the door. And it tends to sort of blunt the...
dampens the debate.
Yes, prevent the public input, which on this subject has been consistently negative. One of the interesting things on this was that the consultant, and I've seen this happen again and again, they hire these consultants at enormous amounts of money. The BSAW plan has spent well over $500,000 on consultants, and so they hand this over to look at these alternative alignments for Third Street. The consultant comes up with one that accomplishes all of the essential objectives and reduces the number of houses that would have to be torn out, and had a number of other features that I thought were attractive. I thought it was clearly better than the other alternatives, but the council had come to what they had out of session or at some time earlier already concluded was the preferred alignment based on much less